blanket over himself. He tried to keep his eyes open as the GC-CNN pool camera remained trained on the transparent coffin and the endless line of the mourning faithful from around the world. Knowing that young David Hasid and his lady friend Annie Christopher were there, along with who knew how many other believers, he began silently walking through his prayer list. When he closed his eyes to pray for his comrades and his cyber congregation, more than a billion now, he felt himself nodding and his brain longing for sleep. He peeked at the digital clock on the video disc player atop the TV. He set the machine to record just in case he fell asleep and was unable to wake up in time for the event. As he settled back in to try to pray, knowing full well he would drift off, the clock showed 12:57 in the afternoon. Zion began praying for Chloe, Leah, and Rayford, whom he knew were in the state. Then he prayed for T, Rayford's friend, who was presently unaccounted for. Then Cameron, always in the middle of something and who knew where. As his mind drifted to his old friend and professor, Dr. Rosenzweig, Zion began feeling a tingle, much like when he had tried to intercede for Rayford. Was it fatigue? A hallucination? So disconcerting, so real. He forced his eyes open. The clock still read 12:57, but he felt as if he were floating, and when he let his eyes fall shut again, he could still see plain as day. The cramped cellar was cool and musty, the sparse furniture in its place. Kenny slept unmoving in the playpen, blankets still tucked around him. Zion saw this from above now, as if in the middle of the room. He saw himself asleep on the couch. He had heard of out-of-body experiences, but had never had one or dreamed one. This didn't seem like a dream, didn't feel like one. He felt weightless, moving higher, wondering if the joists from the flooring above would conk him on the head as he rose, and whether that would hurt a floating, hallucinating, dreaming, praying, or sleep-deprived man. He wasn't sure what kind of a man he was right then, but despite his incredible lightness of being, he felt as conscious and aware as he had ever been. Though he knew he was unconscious, he had never been so attuned to his senses. He could see clearly and feel everything, from temperature to the air moving over the hair on his arms as he ascended. He heard every noise in the house, from Kenny's breathing to the refrigerator kicking on as he passed it. Yes, he had drifted through the first floor, but he could still see Kenny, and neither worried nor felt guilty about leaving him. For he saw himself, too. Still on the couch, knowing that if Kenny needed him, he could return as quickly as he had left. The fall air was crisp above the house, yet he was glad he was in shirt sleeves. It was not uncomfortable, but he was so aware of everything, feeling, seeing, hearing, the wind through the dead leaf trees. He even smelled the decaying leaves on the ground, though no one burned them anymore. No one did anything anymore that used to be mundane. Life was about surviving now, not about incidentals. If a task didn't put food on the table or provide shelter, it was ignored. In an instant, Zion instinctively shot his arms out for balance and felt as if he had returned almost to his sleeping form in the underground. But the house, the half-destroyed village of Mount Prospect, the northwest suburbs, the twisted ribbons that used to be highways and tollways, the whole Chicago area had become minuscule beneath him. Would he soon grow colder, lose oxygen? How could it be that he was this far from home, now looking at a blue globe that reminded him of the hauntingly beautiful pictures of Earth from the moon? Daylight turned to night, but the earth was still illuminated. He felt as if he were in the deep recesses of space, maybe on the moon. Was he on the moon? He looked about him and saw only stars and galaxies. He reached for the earth because it seemed to recede too quickly. In a strange way, though he couldn't see it anymore, he sensed he and Kenny still slept in Mount Prospect at the safe house. He was soon able to see the planets as he drifted, farther and farther from all that he knew. How fast could he be going? Such physical questions seemed pedestrian, irrelevant. The question was, where was he and where was he going? How long could this go on? It was so strange and wonderful. And for the briefest instant, Zion wondered if he had died. Was he on his way to heaven? He had never believed heaven was on the same physical plane as the universe, somewhere rocket men could go if they had the resources, and at the same time he had never before felt so thoroughly alive. He was not dead. He was somewhere in his mind, he was convinced. In an instant, as he seemed to hang weightless in space, it seemed he accelerated yet again. He raced through the vast universe itself with its numberless galaxies and solar systems. The only sound was his own breathing, and to his amazement, it was rhythmic and deep, as if he were asleep. But he wondered how so puny a mind could dream such a vista. And as if a switch had been pulled, the darkness turned to the brightest light, obliterating the utter darkness of space. Just as the stars disappear in the light of the sun, so everything he had passed on his way to this plateau vanished. He hung motionless in soundless, weightless animation, a sense of expectancy coursing through him. This light, like a burst of burning magnesium so powerful as to chase even a shadow, came from above and behind him. Despite the sense of wonder and anticipation, he feared turning toward it. If this was the Shekinah glory, would he not die in its presence? If this was the very image of God, could he see it and live? The light seemed to beckon him, to will him to turn. And so he did. Chapter 13. Rayford drove as close as he could to the Chicago city limits, staying on a rebuilt collar road that had ominous warning signs its entire length, prohibiting traffic beyond its northern line. Patrolling GC cars ignored the sparse traffic, so Rayford looked for a turn that would appear to take him into a local area, but which might lead him off-road to the city. He felt as conspicuous and obvious as he had in a long time, bouncing over dusty lots and through closed forest preserves in the middle of the day, but he detected no tail. He parked the Land Rover beneath a crumbling former L station. He and Chloe and Leah sat in the shade, Rayford beginning to feel the fatigue that had preceded his wonderful sleep in Greece. "This is my fault," Chloe said. "I was impatient and stupid and selfish. No way we can walk into Chicago until tonight." "And how far is it? 20 miles to the Strong Building? It'll take hours." Leah shifted in her seat. "If you're looking for someone to argue with you, I can't. I'm not trying to be mean, but we're going to sit here until dark. Then we're going to walk at least 5 hours to, what, check out our next safe house?" Chloe sat shaking her head. "We're not walking anywhere," Rayford said. "I know this town like the back of my hand. When it's good and dark, we're going to drive to the building with our lights off. The GC aren't keeping people out of here for fun. They really believe it's contaminated. If we have to turn on the lights now and then to keep from getting swallowed up in a hole, and some surveillance plane spots us or some heat detector locates us, at worst they'll warn us to get out. They're not coming in after us." "No, Dad," Chloe said. "The worst that will happen is that they force us out and figure out who you are." "They would keep their distance and check us for radiation first. And finding none, there goes our whole plan." "There's enough to think negatively about these days," Rayford said. "Let's think positive. Bad enough I have to give Buck the news about his family soon."
"Let me do that, Dad."
"Are you sure?"
"Absolutely. When he calls, let me talk to him."
But when Buck called, it was clear this was still not the time to give him news like that. Rayford watched as Chloe seemed to disintegrate on the phone.
"Thank you, sweetheart," she said. "Thanks for telling us. We'll be praying. I love you, too, and Kenny loves you. Call me as soon as you can. Promise me?"
Chloe rang off and quickly brought Rayford and Leah up to speed. "So that's where T is," Rayford said. "Good thinking on Buck's part. We need to pray for them right now."
"Especially for Chaim," Chloe said. "He sounds close."
"Landing on one wheel is risky," Rayford said, "but it can be done. I think this is T's first time in a Super J, though."
"What kinds of odds would you give them?" Leah said, then appeared to regret asking, realizing Chloe could lose her husband within the next 20 minutes.
"No, I want to know, too," Chloe said. "Really, Dad, what are their chances?"
Rayford stalled but saw little value in getting Chloe's hopes up. "About 1 in 2, he said. Chaim called for Buck, who had joined T in the cockpit. Buck went back and knelt near Chaim's seat.
"One more question," Rosenzweig said. "Dare I test God?"
"How?"
"Tell him I want to believe. Offer him what's left of my life, and just see if he'll accept me in spite of my selfish motive."
"I can't speak for God," Buck said, "but it seems to me if we're sincere, he'll do what he promised. You already know that this is about more than mere believing, because you believe now. The Bible says the demons believe and tremble. It's a decision, a commitment, a receiving."
"I know."
"We're about 15 minutes out, Chaim, give or take circling and getting some tower help. Don't stall."
"But you see," Chaim said, "that just contributes to my problem.
I won't be any more just because my time may be running out. I may be even less."
"Let God decide," Buck said. Chaim nodded miserably. Buck didn't envy his having to work this out while wondering how long he had to live. Chloe and Kenny were at the forefront of Buck's mind, and knowing he would see them again in 3.5 years regardless did nothing to abate his desperation not to leave them. He headed back to the seat next to T.
"I've been in touch with the tower at an airport south of Ptolemais called Kozani. They agree I might have a better shot trying a belly landing than trying to put down on one wheel. No telling how strong that one is or how good a pilot I am. If I'm not perfect, we bounce and that's it. Going in flat will allow me to land at the slowest possible speed and hope for the best."
"You've got to be really smooth, don't you?"
"Tell me about it."
"You gonna fly over low first and see if they can get a look at the wheels?" T pointed to the fuel gauge buried on empty.
"You tell me."
"Well, that could be good news, couldn't it?"
"How so?"
T said.
"If we crash, we don't burn."
"If we crash, Buck, you're gonna wanna burn. You're gonna wish we were vaporized." Zion felt such a sense of peace and well-being that he didn't want this to end, dream or not. He knew he should be terrified to turn and face the light, but it was the light itself that drew him. He didn't move as if in water or in a vacuum. He didn't have to move his limbs. All he had to do was will himself to turn, and he turned. At first, Zion believed he was looking into a bottomless crevice, the only dark spot in a wall of bright white. But as he backed away from the image, so real he believed he could touch it, other dark spaces of relief came into view. As his eyes adjusted to the light, he pulled back far enough to make out a face. It was as if he dangled between the nose and cheekbone of some heavenly Mount Rushmore image. But this was neither carved from stone nor made of flesh and bone. Huge and bright and strong, it was also at once translucent, and Zion was tempted to will himself to pass through it. But as it should have been frightening and wasn't, he wanted to see the whole. If a head, then a body.
He pulled back to see the face ringed with hair massive as prairie grass. It framed a face kindly and yet not soft, loving and yet confident and firm. Zion knew beyond doubt he was imagining this, and at the same time it was the most sensory-rich experience of his life. It burned into his mind's eye, and he believed he would never forget it nor experience anything like it again as long as he lived. His voice nearly failed him, but he managed to croak, "Are you Jesus the Christ?" A rumble, a chuckle, a terrestrial laugh. "No," came a gentle voice that surrounded him, and, coming from a mouth that size, should have blown him into oblivion. "No, son of earth, I am merely one of his princes." Zion pulled back farther to take in the scope of this beautiful heavenly being. "Gabriel?" he whispered. "Gabriel and I are as brothers, child. He announces, 'I command the heavenly host.'" It came to Zion at once. The great sword, long as the Jordan, the breastplate, big as the Sinai. "You are Michael, the prince who shall defend my people, the chosen ones of God. You have said it. Prince of God, have I died? Your time has yet to come. May I inquire more?" "You may, though I prefer righteous warfare to conversation. Gabriel announces, 'I engage in battle.'" "A selfish question, sir. Will I remain until the glorious appearing?" "It is appointed unto men once to die, and..." "But will I die before the..." "That is not for you to know, created one. It has no bearing on your obligation to serve the Most High God." Zion wanted to bow to this being and to the truth he spoke. He could not believe he had interrupted Michael the Archangel, one of only two named angels in all of Scripture. "Why am I here if I am not dead?"
"You have much to learn, teacher."
"Will I learn the identity of Antichrist, the enemy of God?" Michael seemed to grow stony, if that were possible for an angel. It was as if the mere mention of Antichrist had stoked his bloodlust for battle. He spoke again.
"Antichrist shall be revealed in due time."
"But, sir," Zion said, feeling like a child, "is not now the due time?"
"We measure past, present, and future with different rods than you, son of earth. The due time is the due time, and to the prudent and watchful ones the revelation will be clear."
"We'll know for sure the identity of the enemy?"
"So I have spoken."
"Teach me all. I am here to learn, great prince who stands watch over the sons of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob."
"Stand silent," the angel said. "Observe and give ear to the truth of the war in heaven. Since the calling up of the righteous dead and alive, the enemy has competed with the hosts of heaven for the remaining souls of men. The evil one, that old serpent, has had access to the throne of the Most High since the beginning of time, until now, the appointed time."
What was he saying? That Zion was there to witness the end of Satan's access to the throne, where for millennia he had exercised his power to accuse the children of God? Zion wanted to ask how he earned so great a privilege, but Michael put a finger to his lips and beckoned with his other hand for Zion to look past him to the very throne room. Zion immediately fell prostrate in what seemed the mid-air of the extended universe. He saw only one figure, bigger, brighter and more beautiful than Michael himself. Zion covered his eyes. Is it the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world? Silence, son of earth! This is neither son nor father whom you will not see until your due time. Before you is the angel of light, the beautiful star, the great deceiver, your adversary, Lucifer. Zion shuddered, repulsed, yet unable to look away. Is this the present? He asked. Eternity past and future are the present here, Michael said. Listen and learn. Suddenly, Zion was able to hear the beautiful angel plead his case before the throne, which was beyond Zion's view. Your so-called children are beneath you, ruler of heaven, came the persuasive, mellifluous tones of the eternal solicitor. Abandon them to me who can fashion them for profit. Even after being called by your name, their natures reek with temporal desires. Allow me to surround myself with these enemies of your cause, and I will marshal them into a force unlike any army you have ever assembled. From the throne came a voice of such power and authority that volume was irrelevant.
Thou shalt not touch my beloved.
But with them I shall ascend to a throne higher than yours.
No!
They are weak and ineffective in your service.
No!
I can salvage these hopeless wrecks.
Thou shalt not.
I beseech you, ruler of heaven and earth.
No!
Grant me these, or I will...
No!
I will...
No!
I will destroy them and defeat you.
I shall bear the name above all other names. I shall sit high above the heavens, and there shall be no God like me. In me there shall be no change, neither shadow of turning.
Suddenly from Zion's right, he saw the flash in the eyes of Michael the archangel, and he spoke with great emotion.
God the Father Almighty,
he shouted, causing the evil one to look his way in disgust, then anger. I beseech you, allow no more blasphemy in the courts of heaven. Grant that I destroy this one and cast him out of your presence. Yet Michael apparently neither heard nor sensed the permission of God. Lucifer glared with contempt at Michael, smirking, laughing. He turned back to face the throne.
Michael, your master shall not assign you an impossible task. He knows I am right about the sons of God. He will eventually concede them to me.
You are a fool, weak, and unable to face me on your own. You shall lose.
I shall win. I shall ascend.
But as Zion watched and listened, Lucifer's voice changed. It became high-pitched and whiny, and his persona began to change. As he railed and begged and challenged and blasphemed, the voice from the throne continued to deny him. His bright shining robe lost its luster, his face curled into a hideous mask of scales, his hands and feet disappeared, and his garment fell off, revealing a slimy, writhing, coiling serpent. His eyes sank under deep hoods, and his voice became a hiss, then a roar, as he seemed to transform himself. His hands and feet reappeared, but his fingers and toes had turned to great horned appendages. He dropped to all fours. His words had vanished into flaming breaths, and he paced before the throne with such anger that Zion was glad Michael stood between him and this dragon. His head grew horns, and a crown appeared upon it, and suddenly his whole being turned fiery red.
As Zion watched in horror, the beast grew 6 more heads with crowns and a total of 10 horns. Pacing and growing ever larger with each step, the beast shook itself in rage and threatened the throne and they that sat upon it. And the voice from the throne said,
"No!"
With a great roar and stomping and shaking of its heads, the dragon postured threateningly and appeared to want to advance on the throne. Michael stepped that way, and the voice again said,
"No!"
Michael turned to Zion. "Behold," he said, pointing behind Zion. Zion turned to see the figure of a woman with clothes as bright as the sun. While Michael's brightness had nearly blinded him, and Lucifer proved brighter still, the woman appeared as if clothed in the sun. It seemed she stood on the moon itself, and on her head was a wreath made of 12 stars. Zion was transfixed and felt a great kinship with the woman. He wanted to ask Michael who she was, Mary, Israel, the church. But he couldn't speak. Couldn't turn. He was aware that the hideous 7-headed dragon was behind him, but that Michael stood between him and that danger. The woman was pregnant, her great sun-clothed belly causing her to turn and cry out in labor pains. She grimaced and her body convulsed in contractions, and as she held her abdomen as if about to give birth, the dragon leaped from his place before the throne, clearing Michael and Zion and pouncing before the woman. His great tail swept a third of the stars from the heavens, and they plummeted to the earth, and now he crouched before the woman who was ready to give birth, 7 mouths open and salivating, tongues darting, ready to devour her child as soon as it was born. She bore a male child who was caught up to God. The dragon watched in rage as the child was transported to the throne, and when he turned back to the woman, she had fled. He rose up to give chase, and Michael the archangel said, "Behold!" Zion turned to watch him use both mighty hands to pull the golden sword from its sheath and swing it in a high arc over his head. Immediately he was joined by a heavenly host of warrior angels who fell in behind him, as the dragon's angels also mustered behind him. Zion had so many questions, but Michael had led the charge against the dragon. Perhaps Gabriel the announcer was close by. Zion opened his mouth to ask, but when he said, "Who is the woman?" his words sounded plain to him, and he felt enclosed. "Who is the woman?" he repeated. And his words woke him with a start. He sat up and his blanket slid off. The TV still showed the slow-moving line of mourners bathed in the eerie palace courtyard spotlights. Zion stood and peered into the playpen where Kenny slept, having not moved. He sat back down and stared unbelieving at the video disc player clock. It read 12:59. Movement in the cabin caught Buck's eye. In the darkness he saw Chaim unstrap himself and awkwardly kneel in the aisle, his elbows on the armrest. Buck touched T's arm and nodded back. T looked and glanced at Buck, who raised both fists and bowed his head. He turned sideways so he had one ear facing the cabin. The man who had been so endearing and so stubborn was finally on his knees. "Oh, God," Chaim began. "I have never before prayed believing that I was actually talking to you. Now I know that you are there and that you want me, and I don't know what to say." He began to weep. "Forgive me for coming to you only because I am afraid for my life. Only you know the truth about me, whether I am sincere. You know better than I. I know that I am a sinner and need your forgiveness for all my sins, even for murder, regardless that the victim was your arch enemy. Thank you for taking the punishment for my sins,
Forgive me and receive me into your kingdom. I want to give you all of myself for the rest of my days. Show me what to do. Amen.
Buck looked back to where Chaim remained kneeling, his head buried in his arms.
Cameron, he called, his voice muffled.
Yes, Chaim.
I prayed, but I'm still scared.
So am I.
Me too, T said.
You tested God? Buck said.
I did. I guess I won't know his decision until we crash and I wake up in heaven or hell.
Oh, the Bible says we can know.
It does?
It says his spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God.
What does your spirit say?
My spirit says to land carefully.
Buck laughed in spite of himself.
Chaim, there is a way we can know in advance. Do you want to know?
With all my heart.
T, turn the lights on back there.
David stood atop the observation tower again, watching the line. With a couple of hours to go before midnight, the air was cool enough to keep the crowd calm. The next day was expected to be over 100 degrees, and he worried about health and tempers. The funeral was to begin in 12 hours, but David couldn't imagine the crowds having completely passed by the bier that soon. From his perch, he could see the final touches on the massive, black, hollow, iron and bronze image of the late potentate, made from a post-mortem body cast. Guy Blod seemed about to burst, supervising the last welds and the winching of it into place. Guy would stand on a scaffold and do the final sanding and polishing himself, planning to have workmen roll the finished product near the bier sometime before dawn. Fortunato and his lackeys were making the rounds, and Leon had a couple of folded sheets of paper in his hand and seemed to be taking copious notes. He and his entourage visited the statue-making operation, where Guy broke long enough to animatedly point out the features and accept accolades from the Supreme Commander. The Fortunato juggernaut moved to the middle of the long line where many had been waiting for hours. People bowed and knelt and kissed his hands. Often he lifted them and pointed up to the bier, and they stood nodding and gesturing. Leon checked the various concession tents and stands, none of which would open until daybreak. When he got to the stand beneath where David stood, David's worst fears were realized.
"Anyone seen Director Hasid?" Leon said.
While his people were shaking their heads, someone in the tent said,
"He's upstairs, Commander."
"With whom?"
"Alone, I think.
Gentlemen, wait for me, would you?"
He mounted the steps, and David felt the whole structure sway. David acted as if he was not expecting anyone and hadn't heard anyone come up.
"Director Hasid, I presume," Fortunato said. David turned.
"Commander,
want to join our little group, David? We're just greeting the people."
"No, thanks. Long day. I'm about to turn in."
"I understand," Leon said, pulling the pages from his pocket. "Have time to give me a little input?"
"Sure."
"I'm getting pressure from a few people in Rome for a memorial service for Pontifex Maximus. Remember him?"
Leon had asked that seriously, as if David wouldn't remember the head of the One World Faith who had died within the week.
"Of course," David said. "Well, he seems to have faded from most people's memories, and I'm inclined to leave it that way."
"Not have the service, you mean?"
"You agree?" Fortunato said. "I'm just asking." "Well, I agree with you that we probably shouldn't have it."
That wasn't what David had said, of course, but there was no sense squabbling. Fortunato was likely eliciting the same forced ideas from everyone around him, and he would eventually find himself acquiescing to the counsel from his staff.
I would like spiritual matters centralized here in New Babylon for good, and I believe there's a place for a personal expression of faith better than what that amalgam gave us. Everyone seemed to go for that all faiths into one idea, Commander. Yes, but with mounting evidence that Potentate Carpathia deserves sainthood and the possibility that he himself was divine, I believe there's a place for worshipping and even praying to our fallen leader. What do you think? I think you will prevail. Well, thank you for that. David, I have found you a most capable and loyal worker. I want you to know that you can name your role in my regime. Your regime? Surely you don't see anyone else in line for Supreme Potentate. David was tempted to tell him who the Potentate would be very soon. No, I don't suppose. I mean, if you do, tell me. I have people watching the three dissident kings closely, and I think Litwala has a lean and hungry look. You know where that's from, Hasid? Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. You are well-read. What role would motivate you? I'm happy where I am, sir. Really? Yes. Well, how would you respond to a healthy raise and a title change, say Special Assistant to the Supreme Potentate? David knew this would all be moot soon. I wouldn't oppose it, he said. You wouldn't oppose it, Fortunato laughed. I like that. Look at this list of people who want to say a few words at the funeral tomorrow, he swore. Self-serving sons of the devil. Takes one to know one, David thought. You want to say a few words? No. Because I could squeeze you in. No, thank you. It'd be no problem. Give you some visibility. No. Going to get some rest, eh? Yes, sir. And you'll be back when? Daybreak, I imagine. Problem, sir? I was looking for someone from our level to be here when the statue is put in place. Blod's a minister. Yeah, but you know. David didn't know, but he nodded nonetheless. Could you be there, David? Whatever you say, sir. Attaboy. Buck moved into the cabin as Chaim rose and turned to face him. He looked exhausted and was tear-stained. Chaim now had his back to the armrest he had leaned on, and it caught him just above the knee. Buck put a hand on each of Chaim's shoulders, and the old man lurched back and plopped into the seat, his feet on Buck's knees. "So you saw it, did you?" Buck said. "Yes," Chaim said, rising. "And you can see mine?" He maneuvered until he was directly under a light, and he held a shock of white hair out of the way. "I sure can, Chaim. You didn't believe us all this time, did you? That we could see each other's marks, I mean." "Actually, I did believe you," Chaim said. "Not all of you would have lied to me. I was so jealous. No more. So God knew my heart. Apparently. That in itself is a miracle." "Prepare for descent," T hollered. "I can't say I'm any less scared," Chaim said. "I'm scared too, friend, but a lot less than I would be if I didn't know my destination." Chapter 14. Leah was tired and bored, despite being fascinated by the change in Rayford and the relationship between him and his daughter. Even with the windows open and a chilly breeze coming through, the Land Rover was cramped and oppressive. When her phone rang and it was Ming, she was alarmed but glad for the diversion. "I am going to get to see my parents and my brother again," Ming said. "That's great. How? Where?" "At the funeral." "You're going?" "And so are they. I called to tell them I had been assigned crowd control and they insisted on coming." "Well, that's good, isn't it?"
Leah, I'm so worried about my parents. They do not know about either Chang or me being believers. They were such admirers of Carpathia that they are sick with grief. I want to tell them and persuade them, but it would take a miracle.
It's always a miracle, Ming. We'll pray with you that it will happen.
You don't know my father.
I know, but God is bigger than any of that.
How are you getting to New Babylon? I heard all flights were full.
Military transport. I don't know how my family found seats except that my father has a lot of influence with the GC. His business contributes more than 20% of its profits to New Babylon. They are expecting another 1 million people there tomorrow. I'm telling you, Leah, even prisoners here are mourning Carpathia.
When you're there, look up David Hasid and Annie Christopher.
Believers?
Of course.
Keep up the front. Pretend to argue with them. They'll notice your mark and play along to protect you.
Introduce your brother.
I'll tip them off that your parents don't know.
Hey, any more news on Hattie or Cameron Williams' family?
A pause.
You can tell me, Ming.
Well, it's sort of good news and bad news.
Shoot.
The Williams's home burned and 2 bodies were discovered, identified as Cameron Williams's father and brother.
And?
This is unconfirmed, Leah, but there is some evidence that they may have become believers.
That will be so helpful if Buck could know that for sure.
I'll see what I can find out without being too obvious, but someone said the murders and the torching had to wait because they were at a church-type meeting.
Does that mean the GC knows where the church meets?
Likely. They know more than most believers want to think.
We've got to warn that church.
Buck listened to T talk on the radio to the tower at Kozani.
Very low on fuel. I may make 1 test pass, but I'd better go for it.
On the downside, Super Juliet, we have no foam and no prospects to get any soon. You might want to jettison remaining fuel before the final attempt.
Roger that.
You have friends in high places, Juliet.
Repeat?
You have new equipment coming.
I'm not following you, Tower.
Man named Albie. Know him?
Heard of him. Friend of a friend.
That's what he said. He's delivering a plane for you, assuming yours is going to need some rehab.
Roger, what's he bringing?
No idea.
How's he going to get back?
I believe he's planning to do the fix on yours and take it in trade.
He'd better be bringing something pretty nice.
Just hope yours is worth trading after you scrape our runway.
Roger.
Buck looked at T. Do you believe that? Rayford had to set that up.
Wonder when Albie's expected.
Buck shook his head. He's got a lot longer flight than we do, and who knows where he's getting the craft.
I can't wait to see it.
I can't wait to see if we survive.
I believe we will, T said. We'll take a look at the situation, jettison and slider in there nice and smooth.
I love the confidence in your voice.
Must be my acting background.
Don't say that.
Truth is, Buck, I need both of you strapped in the very back seats. I'll call out altitude readings. By 50 feet, you should be braced and tucked, but you can get into that position any time after you hear 100 feet. Got it?
Buck nodded.
We're close. Get Chaim ready.
Buck stood and was moving into the cabin when T said,
Oh, no!
What? The interior lights went dark. Battery-operated emergency lights eerily illuminated the control board.
What's happening? Chaim called out. Someone talk to me.
Let's just say we won't have to jettison fuel, T said.
Get strapped in now, back seats, and don't talk to me till we're on the ground.
I'm ready for heaven, Chaim said. But tonight I prefer asphalt to gold, if you don't mind.
Shut up, doctor, T said.
And he called the tower on batteries.
Mayday, Kozani Tower, this is Super J, and we're out of fuel. Repeat, out of fuel. On battery backup.
Landing lights may not be fully operational.
Roger, Juliet, came the response as Buck settled in across the aisle from Chaim.
Landing gear retracted?
Roger, T said. Wheels up. Stand by.
Repeat. Did we get a wheels up confirm?
Negative.
Due to power out, or do you think the wheels are not up?
Didn't feel anything.
Keep in mind as you come in. You have us in sight?
Affirmative.
All runway lights on.
Thank you. Landing lights on.
Roger. Repeat wheels up procedure.
Roger.
Successful?
Negative.
We'll try to see when you come in. It will affect your drag and what you want to do.
Roger.
Altitude?
1,000 and falling. 900. 8.
Dropping too fast, Juliet. You must clear south fence.
Affirmative. Working on it. 7. 6. 550.
Must slow descent, Juliet.
Worried about airworthiness.
Roger, but fence must be top priority.
Roger. 4, 3, 2.
Zion stood and stretched and checked on Kenny. He felt as if he'd been out for hours, yet he was as weary as when he nodded off. While he was determined not to miss anything in New Babylon, he knew he needed sleep. He sat back down and settled in, hoping, praying, he would again be transported to the very portals of heaven. He didn't know what to call what had happened to him or how to assess it, but it had been the privilege of a lifetime. He was left with so many questions and so much more to come, but before he slept, he again felt compelled to pray for his brothers and sisters on the front lines. David headed for his quarters, phoning Guy on the way.
I'd like to see the positioning of the statue when you're ready.
Now?
I say when you're ready.
The regular schedule will be fine.
You're asking permission?
I'm just saying I'd like to watch. There a problem with that?
I don't need my hand held.
Believe me, Guy, I don't want to hold your hand. Protocol demands that you not refer to me by my first name.
Sorry, Blood.
It's Blood, and my last name isn't appropriate either.
Oh, I don't think it's that bad.
Ooh, my title is Minister.
Sorry, Reverend Minister.
But your Supreme Commander and mine wants a liaison from administration present when you move Naked Boy into position.
How rude and tacky.
That's sort of what I thought, but I'm surprised you agree.
David?
Director Hasid to you, Minister Blood. Anyway, he chose me, so don't leave home without me.
David, I am a minister. Therefore, I qualify as a liaison from administration. You just stay in bed until you can be civil.
Sorry, Minnie. But I have a direct order. If you want to contest it, you may take it up with him.
Just wait till he hears what you called the potentate.
Oh, if you tell him that, please clarify that I was referring to your statue. And you might add that you yourself admitted it was, what did you say, rude and tacky.
5 a.m., Hayseed, and we're not waiting for you.
Oh, good. I'd hate to miss that. Have a nice day.
Buck knew he should have his head buried, as Chaim did, but he was too curious. He leaned out into the aisle where he could see through the cockpit. The plane was too steeply nose down, and clearly T was going to try one last maneuver to somehow clear the south fence, which preceded about 100 yards of grass and then the runway. It struck Buck that most of the tire marks on the runway were at least a quarter mile from the edge of the pavement, and only a couple of others showed nearer, none of them really close to the grass. He wouldn't bet T could get the Super J over the fence, let alone into the grass. Forget the runway proper.
Your landing gear is down, Juliet. Repeat, down. Full wheel on right, partial assemblage on left. Lift. And good luck.
We don't do luck,
Buck shouted as the fence disappeared from view. God, do your thing through T.
Roger, T shouted as he yanked on the stick. The plane bucked ever so slightly, clearing the fence, then swept tail first onto the grass. The impact slammed Buck so deep into his seat that he felt it in every fiber of his being. Chaim had let out a terrific grunt on impact, and it seemed his face was near his shoes. Buck wished he'd been in the same position because he felt soft tissue give way from his tailbone to his neck, and he was sure both shoulders had nearly been torn from their sockets. He felt it in his feet, ankles, and knees, and the plane was still nose up as the rear tore through the sod. That meant at least one more impact was to come, but Buck couldn't imagine they would feel it in the back, at least not the way they felt the first one. The angle and speed T had brought the plane in on somehow carried the craft all the way to the runway on its tail. When the tail hit the edge of the runway, the nose slammed down in a shower of sparks so fast that the front half of the fuselage tore away from the back, and the two huge pieces of airplane went sliding and scraping, spinning in opposite directions. Buck was aware of sky and pavement and lights and hangars and sparks and noise and dizziness until the G-forces were too much and he felt himself losing consciousness. Lord, he said as blissful darkness invaded his brain, I can recover from this. Leave me here a while. Chloe, I love you. Kenny. Exhausted as he was, David could not sleep. He lay in his quarters, wondering why he got such joy out of tormenting Guy Blod. He couldn't shake from his memory Rayford's story of having tormented Hattie Durham's friend Beau, and how Beau had eventually committed suicide. Sure, Guy was a case, and David enjoyed beating him in a battle of wits and sarcasm, but was he laying groundwork for ever having a positive influence on the man? Guy's becoming a believer seemed remote, but who would have guessed David himself would have ever come to faith? A young Israeli techie with street smarts, he had been a skeptical agnostic his whole life. Could he start over with Guy, or would the man laugh in his face? Regardless, he had to do the right thing. David tapped out a love message for Annie, telling her that while he agreed they shouldn't even think about children until after the glorious appearing, he still wanted to marry her. Her response would determine his next move in the relationship. He took one last look at messages and email and thought he had an idea where every Trib Force member was, all absent and accounted for, he decided. By now, Buck and Chaim ought to be in Greece. He wondered what Chaim was doing for identification. With a brief prayer for Zion, who he hoped would get back to his daily internet studies and commentaries soon, David fell into bed. He asked forgiveness for how he had treated Guy Blod and asked God to give him special compassion for the man. Of course, it wouldn't be safe for him to declare himself a believer to a GC insider yet, but he didn't want to shut the door to opportunities once he and Annie had escaped. Buck's eyes flew open, and he feared he might be going into shock. The night air hit him like a polar blast, though he knew it wasn't that cold. He couldn't even see his breath. He sat in the jagged back half of the Super J, staring straight down the runway to the front half, which faced him about half a mile away. He had to get out, get to T, make sure he was okay. T had saved their lives. What a masterful job of flying the lifeless bird. Chaim. Buck looked to his left to find the old man still curled upon himself, bent all the way forward, the back of his head pressed against the seat in front of him. How could he not have broken his neck? Did Buck dare move him? Chaim! Chaim, are you all right? Rosenzweig didn't move. Buck gently touched Chaim's back and noticed that his own hand quivered like the last leaf on a maple tree. He clasped his hands together to control himself, but his whole body shuddered. Was anything broken, punctured, severed? It didn't appear so, but he'd be sore for days, and he must not allow himself to slip into shock.
Worried about Chaim, Buck unstrapped himself and reached for his right wrist, which was by Chaim's foot, his hands tightly wrapped around the ankles. He couldn't loosen Chaim's grip, so he forced his fingers between Chaim's leg and wrist. Not only did he have a pulse, but it was strong and dangerously fast. Buck heard footsteps and shouting as three emergency workers appeared, demanding to know if there were any survivors.
"I need a blanket," he said. "Freezing. And he needs someone who knows what they're doing to get him out of here and check for neck injuries."
"Blood," one of the men said.
"Where?" Buck said.
"The man's shoes. Look."
Blood dripped from Chaim's face to his shoes.
"Sir," they called to him. "Sir!"
Turning to Buck, one said,
"What's his name?"
"Just call him Doctor. He'll hear you." Someone tossed Buck a blanket, and he saw more workers sprinting down the runway to the other half of the plane. He tried to stand. Everything hurt. His head throbbed. He was dizzy. He pulled the blanket around himself, feeling every muscle and bone, and staggered out the front of the wreckage to solid ground. He stood there swaying, assuring everyone he was all right. He had to get to T. There was nothing he could do for Chaim. If the worst he had was a racing pulse and facial lacerations, he should be all right. It was too late to tell him not to use his own name. Buck started toward the other end of the runway, but he moved so slowly and shook so much that he wondered if he could make it. The ground beckoned and almost took him several times. But though he knew he had to look like a drunk, he kept forcing one foot in front of the other. An emergency medical technician ran toward him from the cockpit half, and another came from the tail end. As they got close to Buck, he thought they were going to carry him the rest of the way. He would not have resisted. But they ignored him and shouted to each other. The one from behind him told the other,
"Old guy back there looks like the Israeli who died in a house fire last night."
"He gets that a lot," Buck said, realizing that neither heard him.
"How's the pilot?"
the first EMT said, but Buck didn't hear the response.
"What'd he say?"
he called after the man, who was now running for the cockpit.
"He didn't."
Buck hadn't seen the man shake his head in response either, but maybe he hadn't been watching carefully enough. At long last, he arrived at the front end of the plane. No one was working on T. That could be good or bad. He heard someone call for a body bag.
That couldn't be. If he and Chaim had survived the jolt, surely T had. He was in better shape than either passenger.
One of the workers tried to block Buck's way into the plane, but Buck gave him a look and a weak shove, and the man knew there would be no dissuading him.
"Please don't touch the body," the man said.
"It's not a body," Buck slurred. They had for sure misread this one, hurriedly misdiagnosed whatever the problem was.
"It's a friend, our pilot."
The cockpit portion had come to rest directly under a huge runway lamp, which filled the wreckage with light. Buck saw no blood, no bones, no twisted limbs. He stepped behind T, who was sitting straight up, still strapped in. His left hand lay limp on his lap, his right hung open-palmed in the space between the seats. T's head hung forward, chin on his chest.
"T," Buck said, a hand on his shoulder. "How we doing, pal?"
T felt warm, thick, and muscly. Buck put a finger to the right pressure point in the neck. Nothing. Buck felt the blanket slide from his shoulders. He slumped painfully into the seat across from T and grabbed the lifeless hand in both of his.
"Oh, T," he said. "Oh, T."
The rational part of his brain told him there would be more of this. More friends and fellow believers would die. They would reunite within 3.5 years. But though he didn't know T the way Rayford had, this one still hurt. Here was a quiet, steady man who had risked his life and freedom more than once for the Tribulation Force, and now he had made the ultimate sacrifice.
"We need to remove the body and the wreckage, sir. I'm sorry."
This is an active runway.
Buck stood and bent over T, taking his head in his arms. I'll see you at the eastern gate, he whispered. Buck dragged his blanket out of the plane, but could walk no farther. He tried to sit on the edge of the runway, but couldn't catch himself, and rolled on his back. A stiff breeze chilled the back of his neck, and he didn't have the energy to protest when he felt a hand in his pocket.
Anyone meeting you here, Mr. Staub?
Yeah.
Who?
Miklos.
Lucas Miklos, the Lignite guy?
Yeah.
He's in the terminal. Can you make it?
No. We'll get a gurney out here. Buck watched as T's body was lifted out in a bag.
Take care of the old guy back there, Buck managed, pointing the other way.
We've got the old man, someone said. Bloody nose and a jittery heart, but he'll make it.
And Buck was out again.
The skies began to darken in Chicago at around 7, but Rayford decided to wait until 8 to venture out. He wanted the skies black and no one even looking their direction. The city had been abandoned, condemned, and cordoned off for months, and it wouldn't have surprised him to know that not even a leftover drunk walked those streets. Radiation or not, decaying bodies littered many streets. It might be a safer place to hide out, but it was not going to be a fun place to live. He pulled slowly from under the L platform with his lights off, hoping to kick up as little dust as possible. There would be no shooting straight into the loop on the Dan Ryan. Nothing was as it once was. Between separate bombing raids and the great earthquake, some reconstruction had been attempted, but these were meant to be shortcuts, two-lane roads that cut straight through the city. But only a few were even half finished, so the most direct route anywhere was as straight a line as you could point over, under, around, and through the natural and man-made obstacles in the best four-wheel drive vehicle you could find. Rayford guessed he had between 15 and 20 miles to drive, his lights off most of the way, traveling at around 10 miles an hour.
I hope this is all David says it is, he said.
Me too. Chloe said. For my sake. Of course, I watched his little cyber tour of the place. If it's half what it looks like, it's going to be as close to ideal as we can find.